You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Joining us today, and not his first trip here to All Marine Radio, but Mark Kansia. I read his stuff for years in the Marine Corps Gazette and other publications, and he now is senior advisor for international security program for CSIS, Center for Strategic and International Studies. And so Mark joins the program. Mark, first of all, thanks for doing this. I always love having you on and appreciate you doing this.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
We went into your life last time. Pretty interesting. And smart guys in the Marine Corps don't always work out well. But in your case, you did pretty well. A retired colonel. And I had the occasion the other night, actually last night, to watch something that you were a part of a couple years ago. This spring, when CSIS hosted a program on the 50th anniversary of the atrocities that U.S. Army soldiers committed in My Lai, and I just wondered—I know you didn't moderate the forum, but you were in the room. I just wondered your thoughts about that. I thought it was outstanding, and I would recommend to anybody. If you do a little study, if you do a little search on YouTube, CSIS, My Lai, this thing pops up immediately, and it's well worth your time. But I'm curious about your thoughts as you listen to the different speakers and then the question and answer. What did you walk away with that day?
Well, I walked away with a couple of things. First, it was a great program that had really been put together by my colleague, Mark Moyer, who at that point had gone back into the government. But one of the things I walked away with was that the full story of the events has come out. There have been many books, and of course, after the event, there were investigations. So all of the things that occurred and all of the actions of the players has come out. And as we were talking about earlier, you know, a lot of the focus had been on Lieutenant Calley, you know, who was the platoon commander, but the company commander and all the way up the chain, who appeared not to have appeared to have been very culpable, but to have escaped punishment, accountability. But their role has come out, and I think that has been very valuable. It would have been better, of course, if at the time they'd been held accountable. But the fact that at least that has come out is, I think, says a good thing about the military, because in many countries, that sort of thing would never have come out. It would have been continued to be suppressed.
Is there any part of was there any part of the program or any part of the events? I'll tell you one thing that I had not heard so much about were the sexual assault, the rape allegations, and the horrible things that were done that day. I had not seen in the detail that it was presented in your forum. I had not seen that. And a couple other things I didn't know. I did not know that at the time, you know, if you were honorably discharged out of the service, statute of limitations was over. You could not be then charged and returned to active duty or whatever as we adjudicated the charges. So I there was a lot of stuff in there I did not know. Is there anything that you anything particular that you learned that day or that you didn't know? I know you're a colonel, so you knew a lot more than me. But
I think the Army JAG officer who was speaking made strong points that the Army has learned from that experience and has put processes in place to ensure that these things don't happen again. And we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan that atrocities do occur, but nothing has occurred at the scale of a My Lai. And I think that is a tribute to the military, that they have been able to first train their people, you know, to not do these kinds of bad things and hold the chain of command accountable, at least to some degree. Now, you know, there have been incidents that didn't get the review that they probably should have. But fortunately, these incidents, by comparison with My Lai, you know, where you have hundreds of people killed, have been much smaller. So I think that that shows some progress in the way the military fights wars.
Interesting. No, in fact, the incident, the Marine incident in there, you know, talks about the murder of 24 civilians.
I always get confused
with the Sante raid, right? But it's different.
It's something like that.
It's close to it. But not a lot of Marines know that. And now when you think of, you know, the way we're taught the law of land warfare, I mean, one of the things to me that's stunning, and I do a presentation about post-combat related health, about post-traumatic related health, whether you got it in combat or someplace else now. And I play a little bit of video that I found in my studies of My Lai. And it's a PFC by the name of Barnado Simpson. And he murders a woman and a 3-month-old baby. He ultimately commits suicide. His 8-year-old son is murdered in his front yard when two teenagers get in an argument. One pulls out a gun and shoots at the other one. He misses the kid and hits Simpson's 8-year-old son in the head. And in the interview that Simpson does 20 years after My Lai, so in 1988, you know, he said, "I was holding my son, and my son had the same look on his face as that little baby had that I had killed. And I knew then that this was my punishment." It's one of the most powerful things I've ever seen. And then he ultimately commits suicide, I think 7 years after the second interview, because he just can't live with himself anymore. And so to me, the lessons from that are so powerful. And really, the Marine Corps, you know, I then relate it to, you hear "keep your honor clean," right? To Marines. Right, it's in our song, for God's sakes. Who put it in our song, and did they know it was that important? Nobody else's song has a morals clause in it, but ours does. And do you know that if you look at him, who do you keep your honor clean for? You keep your honor clean for you. And his interviews are the best testimony I've ever seen to teaching, whether it's in training, out on liberty, or, you know, in combat. You keep your honor clean for you, and the Marine Corps, whatever institution, is a collateral beneficiary of it. But we've come so far in terms of the teaching of the law of land warfare. But one of the things in the interview he says is that the night before, you know, that Captain Medina said that everything in the village, women, children, babies, dog, cats, water buffaloes, everything was VC, and we were going to kill it. And you think that not an officer, right, not a staff NCO, not an NCO said, "Hey, sir, that's not, we can't do that." You know, it's pretty stunning audio, and you hear that from multiple, you know, guys who served in that company, and just a pretty amazing story. But I thoroughly enjoyed it and just wanted to congratulate you on it.
Well, thanks. And I say my colleague deserves the credit. But to add to what you just said, I think that by discussing these incidents, My Lai and then the Marine Corps one, which was Son Thang, you make people aware of what can happen in the stress of combat, and therefore maybe protect them a little from doing things that are wrong and that they will later regret. And I remember having a conversation with actually John Kelly about his time as assistant division commander, when he got some orders from outside the Marine Corps to take out certain targets. And he pushed back because he said, "You know, we're looking at that and all we see are women and children." And they would say, no, it's all insurgents. And he pushed back, and ultimately they did not strike the target. And then ultimately when they got there, it turned out to be women and children. So I think that the history since then and the investigations, which have been enormously painful, have borne some fruit, so that people like John Kelly, of course, who's a, you know, superb officer, but many others, you know, have the confidence to say, "You know, that just doesn't look right to me."
And then have the courage of your convictions to stand up and say, "We're not doing it."
Because
there is a time and a place. And I'll tell you, just kind of an interesting sidebar. Andy Milburn, Colonel, who was the commanding officer of MARSOC, wrote a piece that I saw in War on the Rocks called something like the moral obligation to disobey. And he is now going to command and staff is going to have him up to speak there for a couple of days. And I thought that's these ethical issues in the gray area of war, right? It speaks highly of the institution. Command. I don't even know who's running command and staff these days, but my hat's off to them because a lot of people won't go near stuff like that. And those are really the substance of discussions about what would you do, you know, that I think create the maturity at the operational level when you have to go do it. And you've gone down this road, you have some repetitions, and it might be only reading, but you've thought about this and you know what to do. And again, that is you protecting your Marines from something like Barnado Simpson went through, where it virtually destroys his life because he can't get away from it. He can't get away from it. So very interesting stuff. Now, the reason I actually have you on today is because much anticipated after the Commandant's guidance, the Commandant's planning guidance is, you know, the next his version of what the Marine Corps will be. And there's been plenty of rumors about, you know, the Marine Corps won't have tanks. The Marine Corps is going to lose tubed artillery. You know, we're going to go down in numbers. And you wrote a piece essentially saying, not so fast. So first of all, what did you write and what was your intent? And then I want to kind of dive into that.
Sure. I wrote a piece called Don't Go Crazy, Marine Corps, for War on the Rocks, which is an online military journal, to raise questions about the direction that at least some people seem to be pushing the Marine Corps. And my argument was the Marine Corps could change and be consistent with both the National Defense Strategy and the Commandant's guidance without giving up all of the capabilities that it would need in different kinds of conflicts, so that it would, no matter what happened, it would still be able to respond. And tanks are a good example. There have been people talking apparently about eliminating all tanks in the Marine Corps, arguing that if you are focused on an island campaign in the Western Pacific, you don't need tanks. You need infantry, you need a bunch of things. But, you know, tanks are for the desert, and therefore the Marine Corps can get rid of tanks. And my argument is, first, of course, you look at World War II, and the Marine Corps used tanks. But the second thing is that the next campaign may not be in the Western Pacific. It could be in Korea. One example is tanks, where some people have suggested that the Marine Corps should get rid of tanks because they aren't very useful in an island campaign in the Western Pacific. My response is that, first, of course, the Marine Corps used tanks in the Second World War when it was fighting on small islands. But we also don't know that the next conflict will be in the Western Pacific. The National Defense Strategy focuses on China and Russia. But given the history of the last 70 years, you know, we could end up in the Middle East. We could end up in Korea. We could end up in a whole bunch of places where tanks would be very useful. So my argument is not that the Marine Corps shouldn't change, but that it should, in this case, keep tanks, but they could have maybe just two battalions on active duty or maybe just one company per MEF, and then beef up the reserves so that the reserves might have two tank battalions or a tank battalion with six companies or something like that. So the Marine Corps still has the capability, but on the other hand, is also changing to focus on what the National Defense Strategy says, which is to focus on Russia and China. And the other reason I make this argument, and again, particularly on tanks, but I think it applies generally, is that some people say, well, you know, you can just get tanks from the Army if you need them. And my response is, no, you're not going to get tanks from the Army, because the Army, the regular Army, is at a very low period also. They're at the level they were in the 1990s. And lower than they were, you know, from before the Second World War. So the regular army is going to need every unit it has just to support itself. And if it's going to provide any support to the Marine Corps, that's going to come out of the Army Reserve components, which in this case means the Army National Guard. And for them to get ready, it's going to take, you know, pick a number, 90 days, 100 days, maybe 180 days for them to get a tank brigade through all of the training it needs and deployed. So if the Marine Corps wants tanks from the Army, it's going to be waiting 3 to 6 months to get those. And that is the antithesis of the rapid response force that the Marine Corps has traditionally been and that General Berger wants to continue to be. So that's why I say you need to, the Marine Corps needs to keep the capability but can use the reserve components and other mechanisms to shift to focus on the threats that the National Defense Strategy sees as most important.
All right, I want you to elaborate on a point that you made in the paper, and that is this. Could you compare and contrast our reserve, the way what constitutes a Marine Corps reserve, and how the other services use theirs?
Yes. The Marine Corps reserve is much, much more ready than the Army, for example. The Air Force is in a little different situation because they keep their flying squadrons at a pretty high level. But the Marine Corps reserve has two huge advantages over the Army. One is that almost all of the officers and many of the enlisted come off of active duty. When I did surveys after the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the average reserve officer had 6 years of active duty when they came into the reserves. So they had done on average their 4 years, and then some of them had stayed a few more years. By comparison, most of the Army Reserve officers don't have any active duty time. They came directly into the reserve component. And that experience then compensates for the fact that reservists only drill, you know, 1 week in the month, 2 weeks in the summer, and therefore cannot build up the reservoir of skills that active duty Marines do. But that 6 years then helps them. And in fact, if you go and look at a reserve infantry battalion, most of the platoon commanders are captains because they just don't have lieutenants. They have a few now that come directly into the reserves. But most are captains. The company commanders are majors, and then, of course, the staff are more senior. And that's their way of compensating for the fact that they are not on active duty as much. You don't see that on the Army side. The other huge advantage is that the Marine Corps Reserve deploys in smaller units. The Army Guard really wants to deploy at brigade level, and it just takes a long time for a brigade to get ready. You know, 90 days is probably the quickest they can do it, and the average is probably above that. The Marine Corps will deploy battalions, which is, can be done much more quickly, and of course they deploy some units at the company level, which can be done very quickly. So with both of those advantages, the Marine Corps Reserve is much more responsive than many of the other services.
The one of the things that shocked me as a company commander, I did some reserve work with reserves supporting a reserve CACs, I want to say in 1992 or 1993, yep, with my LAR company. And I was surprised. It was not what I expected. And it was not what I expected because everybody was more experienced. And they tended to be professional guys. Like your you know, the 81 mortar section leader was like a police captain or something like that. I mean, and then another, I mean, they were all, I mean, they were all older and wiser, and it was an incredible experience. And it was not, you know, you see all the propaganda about the reserves. It was the exact opposite. You know, the young Marines were still young Marines, but the leaders were polished professional guys. And I was like, whoa. whoa, this is actually a cool, unique experience, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. If you had your druthers, talk to me about the configuration. Again, what we're talking about is focusing on near peer warfare, right? And So if it's near peer, does the Marine Corps, do you think the way at least it's come out so far, we don't see ourselves needing tanks. We see ourselves as seizing, littorals, as we seize, advanced naval bases. And, that's our bailiwick. And so to me, and that's how we can give up tanks, because, the fight which may ensue in the vicinity of the South China Sea or someplace that calls China, an adversary, would be completely different than the one that would be, on the list for the next two, which would be Iran and Russia. And so talk to me about that. I mean, that's new. You're getting pretty nuanced there relative to tailoring yourself to a single fight. Yes or no?
Right. And my argument is that the Marine Corps should not tailor itself to a single fight, but should maintain a wide variety of capabilities, but could adjust those between the active and the reserves. For example, for a littoral conflict in the Western Pacific, the Marine Corps needs some new capabilities. For example, anti-ship missiles that can be fired from land, from HIMARS, for example. And such missiles exist, and it's just a question of the Marine Corps building this new kind of unit. And I think that would be very sensible to have Marine HIMAR units, maybe even more HIMAR units, maybe swap out some cannon artillery for HIMARS that have the capability not only to attack targets on land, but can also attack targets on sea, because that is where the National Defense Strategy says we should go. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that the Marine Corps should eliminate all of its cannon artillery, because, as you say, the next fight could be someplace quite different and have very different requirements. But again, the Marine Corps could use the reserves as a way to hedge if it wants to cut back on active duty artillery. The 14th Marines, which is the reserve artillery regiment, could be expanded to four battalions or even five battalions if the Marine Corps wanted, so that that capability again exists. But the Marine Corps has also been able to reshape the active duty structure to align better with a fight in the Western Pacific and the National Defense Strategy.
Talk to me about obviously we've a lot of people are concerned about not being. I'll quote an email. Right. So advanced seizure of naval bases. When did we get away from locate, close with, and destroy? Are those things mutually exclusive?
I don't think so. The campaign could look a lot like the campaign in the Pacific in World War II. Now, I think the way that it's conceptualized is that the Marine Corps would seize these bases before the Chinese got there and would establish a bubble around these bases. Imagine, for example, the Marine Corps setting up units in the Western Philippines, for example, where you might have air units, you might have these artillery units that could reach out and hit shipping, protected by anti-cruise missile, anti-aircraft units, and some infantry, and then forcing the Chinese then to react. And, that is not, there's going to be a lot of shooting around that, but the Marine Corps might not have to actually seize the location. On the other hand, it's quite possible that the Chinese might have moved forward and taken some of these bases the Marine Corps would want to take back. And it's not impossible that the Marine Corps would be directed to take back some of these islands that Chinese have manufactured in the South China Sea.
Interesting. The Now, tell us, when you look at General Berger's vision of the Marine Corps, are there things that you see in there that you really like? And again, there's a lot of pieces on the skeleton that have yet to be publicized. But based on what you've heard, and you're a pretty well connected guy, Mark, are there parts of that you like?
I mean, there are a lot of parts that I think are very interesting. The one that got the headlines was that the Marine Corps was going to move away from the 2-MEB sizing construct for amphibious ships and was also going to move away from the large, expensive amphibious ship to some more distributed amphibious capabilities to be determined. Now, how that plays out will be very interesting, but I think that will have two large benefits. I mean, one is that in peacetime, there will be just more amphibious ships available to do more things, and that would be very valuable when you look at what the MEUs actually do nowadays. A lot of times they're split up so that if you have a 3-ship MEU, each one of the ships is doing something different because there's so much of a demand for amphibious forces.
Right.
So if you had a MEU that was on 5 ships, that would allow you to do just that many more engagements with allies and humanitarian assistance and all the things that the MEUs do. And many of those can be handled by a smaller ship. One of the problems with the large ships is that they're very efficient, extremely capable. But if you sail an LHD up to most countries' coasts, it's larger than their entire Navy put together. And it's just sort of overwhelming. The other great thing about this thing in particular is that it's a new approach to amphibious warfare, more distributed that you might have to execute in the face of a Russia or a China, where they have capabilities that go way beyond what the North Koreans or even the Iranians could muster. So that the notion of a 2-MEB conventional traditional landing is really just not possible. Certainly not possible in a Chinese scenario, and even in the other scenarios, it's questionable. Whereas having a more distributed amphibious capability, might be make it easier, make it even feasible to bring amphibious capabilities to bear. The situation you don't want to be in is where all the amphibs have to stay outside of the Chinese A2AD bubble, their anti-access aerial denial bubble,
right,
until other U.S. forces have beaten the bubble down so that it's smaller and the amphibious forces can now move forward, because that's a prescription for being irrelevant.
Yeah. So Mark, when you see this and you do contemplate Russia and Iran, when you begin to look at, and that's why to me the hearings will be interesting, because we have war plans that the Marine Corps is on the hook to provide certain forces for in those war plans, right?
Yep.
And when you X out tank battalions, plural, from different plans, where are those battalions coming from? And you point to the Army, well, what about you? And they'll look at, wait a minute, right? We're not in the business of, supplying the Marine Corps' hardware that they're on the hook for. Don't let them off. Don't let them do that. I don't understand. I, again, as I try to envision like how this makes its way through Congress, that in particular, the whole tank thing and then the tubed artillery. I had an Artie guy calling me and said, hey, you don't see the Russians going away from tubed artillery. They think it still has utility and they're pretty much the kings of it. They're kings of the king of battle. They love artillery. Give me your thoughts on that. How does this work its way through, Congress, and how does it get balanced out against other war plans? Because that's the difficulty of taking, the steering wheel and saying, yeah, we're going to go right 90 degrees. Well, there's a whole lot of friction on that wheel to get it to 90 degrees or even 45 degrees.
Yeah, I think you're going to see two dynamics in the Congress and when the plan becomes public. One is that there is a lot of support for a focus on China and Russia, particularly China. If you, you know, pulse the community of strategists here in Washington, D.C., they are very focused on China. So they would be very comfortable with a Marine Corps and, in fact, a military in general that focuses on China. Now, I think that's a mistake, a singular focus on China, but that's where this strategy community is right now, not just is headed, but that's where they are. But the Marine Corps also can't just say, no, you know, we are not going to follow the national defense strategy. We are going to ignore the strategic direction we're getting. And that's why in my article I said the Marine Corps can change. It can adapt itself to this new strategy and still not give up these broad capabilities that it has needed in the past and might need in the future in order to be the rapid response, all contingency force that the General Berger wants it to be and that the Marine Corps has been traditionally in the past.
Because the fight against, compare and contrast those, leave Iran out of it. Russia and China, those two missions would be substantially different, yes?
They would. The fight with Russia is a funny one in the sense that the problem isn't the amount of force. The problem is just getting there. Assuming that the fight would be over the Baltics, for example, it's just hard to get there. So, you know, it would be a situation where, you know, NATO would be pushing through Poland maybe and trying to get through the Baltic itself. And, you know, of course, that's very constrained. The Marine Corps likely would have some role there. The Pacific, very different, a maritime, very large theater, lots of space in there, primarily maritime and air, and the Marine Corps would have a very large role there. And that's why Marines and the Navy focus much more on China, whereas the Army focuses on Russia.
Right. Right. In terms of Marine capability in the Pacific, what do you find the most interesting? I mean, a lot of people were very uneasy with the fact that the Marine Corps would give up on 38 amphibs, and you know that a lot of people are very, very uneasy that, and then you heard the commandant say, you know, there's a whole lot of ways to get to the fight. We've got to get better at integrating ourselves with the Navy, and coming off that is not the big deal that everybody thinks it is. What have you, when you look at all the different policy initiatives in terms of the Pacific, what do you find most interesting about it?
Well, I mentioned, of course, the amphibs,
right.
And developing some small amphibs, I think, would be very interesting. It would not be a step away from amphibious warfare, but would be redefining it, reshaping it.
So when you say small amphibs, what does that mean? Is that company level amphibs?
Well, no. Frankly, no one has said yet. Now, one possibility would be an LST sized ship. You know, which of course the Navy used to have. You know, the county class LSTs they're all gone. But you could have something like that again, which is, you know, company size. You could. I wouldn't be surprised if they took some of these MLPs and built more of those as sort of a small auxiliary kind of amphibious ship. Now, they aren't amphibious ships like, you know, the L classes. They don't have all of the survivability, but they're still quite survivable and very flexible. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Navy went in that direction also. But aside from the amphibs, another very interesting thing that General Berger talked about was the need to have larger numbers of systems and to get away from small numbers of very expensive but very capable systems. Now, for most people reading that, it looks like a billboard that says fewer F-35s, more UAVs. And it was talking specifically about aviation. Okay. And if you look at Marine aviation, it started It was one of the pioneers with UAVs with the Pioneer back in the 1980s. And since then has fallen way behind the other services. In the annual report I do about military forces, I have a chart that compares the Marine Corps and the Air Force. The Air Force has 285 missile-firing UAVs, armed UAVs. The Marine Corps has three. And the Marine Corps has plans to go to six. And
wait, Mark, which is going to look awesome, right? We've doubled our capacity relative to shooters. That's awesome. And, how many do you got? We got six.
Huh? I got a pushback from someone, from a Marine, who's saying, no, that graph is wrong. I say, oh, okay, because I was thinking, well, maybe they've got some that I don't know about. He said, no, the three haven't actually been delivered yet. So really, it's 280 to zero. But the point is that the Marine Corps has fallen far behind and needs to build a UAV capability, as the other services have done, which would allow it to have these, larger numbers of air platforms that give you the loiter time and can do, these dangerous, dull, and dirty missions that are hard for aircraft to do. And that doesn't mean that the Marine Corps gets out of the manned aircraft business, but it means it shifts the balance a little so that when you compare the Air Force and the Marine Corps, it's not, 280 to zero.
I can't remember who I had on the program and we were talking, and I don't know if we were talking about unmanned aviation, and the F-35 comes up, but the other things that when we try to replace the AAV, I mean that third thing turned into a monstrosity, and then the question comes like, well, don't we need a lot of these, and don't we need to have some in reserve if we ever go to war? And the answer to that is yes and yes. Well, then and then if you look at simply the number of naval ships. Does every one of them have to be next generation, right? I mean, is there not a balance that we walk with this stuff? Because, look at the Navy we used to have, and now you look at the Navy that we have today, and we can't afford the Navy that we have today because we can't cover enough ground. And so I mean, the point absolutely well taken in that I think General Berger's like, yeah, we need great stuff, right? But we don't need this stuff that breaks the bank and only gives us three, right? Because our capabilities tend to be, right, well beyond anybody that comes close to us, maybe other than the Chinese because they've stolen all of our technology. And so I don't know how you escape that in terms of planning and procurement, but it seems like we do constantly. We can't get it. We can't get it to market, right? We can't. We can't deliver it under budget, and that's not that all poses bad question.
It does. I mean, the requirements process just drives the services to buying very high end, very expensive equipment. We saw that with the EFV, the Marine Corps' attempt to replace the AAVs. And that's why I argue – that's one of the reasons I argue for this spectrum of capabilities. That is that everything doesn't have to be at the high end. You need some things at the high end, but you also need a spectrum of capabilities because they're both more affordable and are applicable in many of the conflicts that you might have to face. If you look at – Korea, for example, it might be useful to have fifth generation aircraft in the first 2 days, until you've beaten down their air defense system. But after that, you can fly F-18s all you want.
Right.
And if all you then have is fifth generation, just a handful, you've missed an opportunity to, provide support for the troops on the ground. So I've argued for a spectrum of capabilities rather than just building at the high end. One of the problems, though, is that the strategy pushes the services to the high end. So, and one of my concerns is in the next budget that you're going to see many of the services cut some of their legacy systems in order to focus on the high end so that they will have fewer but more capable systems. The problem is when you have fewer, it's harder then to cover many different kinds of contingencies, and you're really over-engineered for many of the requirements that you might have. You know, the notion that you're going to use F-35s to drop bombs on insurgents in Afghanistan is crazy. You can do that practically with a Cessna.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I'm sure there's people that said, if you think that we're going to use the F-18, right, to loiter in the sky, to burn that platform up, just to drop a bomb on somebody, you know, you're crazy. But we destroyed Marine aviation, you know, loitering over the skies of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right, because it was the only thing we had. And that's my argument, that with a spectrum of capabilities, you don't have to burn up your high-end capabilities in situations where that is not needed.
Well, Mark, let me ask you that. Why does the Marine Corps seem so resistant, you know, to either leasing? I mean, they're, in fact, I've seen people be critical of the Marine Corps decisions in Iraq and Afghanistan relative to procurement. We could have leased, you know, the MQ-9 Reaper.
Yep.
You know, and we would have saved ourselves thousands of flight hours, which means dozens of F-18s would not have been sitting at, you know, when F-18 in the air capability was at 35% for the Marine Corps, you know, that number wouldn't have been that way. And so how do you seems like putting on your – do you not understand what's going to happen if you burn this out? And then it was – the response was, well, the F-35 is coming. Okay, yeah. When was the last time you saw a first-generation air platform delivered on time? And then they say, yeah, but this one was really late. And so I don't know. It just seems like a series of bad, you know, decisions relative to our advanced capabilities as we burned them up doing either combat air patrol or loitering over the skies of Iraq or Afghanistan. And I benefited from that loitering. But I'll tell you what, you know, it was two of the best platforms. Obviously, the Reaper was awesome. The other one was the Harvest Hawk, the ghettoized, C-130 with a pod on the back that they shoved ordnance out of that stayed up there for 8 hours. That could observe with cameras for you, but it's long, long station time. They were up there forever, and that it was fantastic, as opposed to jets that check on for 45 minutes, you know, go tank, come back for 30, and then they leave. And so I don't know. I'm not, you know, I'm not DCA for aviation. I do play him or her on the radio, though, and I don't know. Some of it just doesn't make sense, and then you see how broke we were. But again, to me, the most glaring argument is for ships. We don't have enough ships to cover. And then you look at, you know, what's coming and what's leaving, and you're like, how does this work? And the Navy wants to get to, what, 355? I don't know. It'll be very interesting. Do you see an inter-service fight brewing between the Army and the Marine Corps about the Marine Corps' vision of itself and the opportunity cost? Because, okay, well, Army, you got to pick up, you know, what the Marine Corps has given away. There's going to be a gap here. There's going to be a gap here. You've got to pick it. Do you see a fight brewing in that?
It's possible. But I think where you're going to see the fight is in a different area. And that is over this ability to provide anti-ship capability from the land. Both the Marine Corps and the Army are experimenting with that and thinking about it. And if the Army were to be the first one to field that capability, then it might become the go-to force for land capability in the Western Pacific and not the Marine Corps, which is why I would urge the Marine Corps to develop that capability pretty quickly. The Army recognizes that its role in the Pacific is likely to be limited, and they've been looking for ways to be useful and have hit on this as one. They're doing a lot of engagement with allies there. They've had a, I think, a brigade, you know, doing engagement, going aboard ship, and engaging with allies on islands. So they have some of that capability, and that is where you might see the inter-service rivalry.
Next question for you. And my guest today is Mark F. Cancian, Senior Advisor, International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's a retired Marine Corps colonel, and he's been gracious enough to rejoin us here talking about how fast the Marine Corps is going to change, the nuances that go with that, the capabilities given away that maybe could be migrated to the reserve. And as everybody waits to see what the Commandant's guidance as it manifests itself in terms of programs, numbers, and whatnot, comes out. First of all, what does the F stand for? What is your middle initial?
Franklin. Named after my grandfather.
All right. I'm a Francis, so I'm sympathetic to getting tagged with a middle name that you don't particularly want. With the middle initial F, so I saw that, and I thought I would ask. Mark, what are you working on next? What's the next thing we're going to see from you?
We have a couple of things. One of them is about industrial mobilization, which sounds really boring, but is actually quite interesting. I got interested in it by doing some analysis on attrition in wartime, because it struck me that when you move to a great power conflict, you may have attrition at a level that we have not experienced it since the Second World War. And so I looked at, for example, particularly tanks, looked at attrition rates in the Second World War, and did some calculations and showed that in a conflict, for example, with Russia in Eastern Europe, the U.S. Army would lose about 30 tanks a day. And if it surged tank production to its maximum level, it could produce 28 tanks a month. So the Army would be ground down to two armored brigades from 15 in about 9 months. And then I thought about, you know, other things you might do, looking at what the Brazilians are producing, for example. I facetiously suggested that we purchase the Moroccan army because they have M1 tanks. But it was clear that our forces were not designed for attrition. So this project that we fortunately got funding for from the Department of Defense looks at production rates, what could be done with a surge production rate, and how long it would take to replace the existing inventory of equipment. Now, that's not the same as meeting wartime attrition, because that requires a different kind of calculation, takes a lot more time, but at least it gives some sense about how long forces might last and where you have weaknesses, because to put it in a Marine Corps context, the Marine Corps is buying, I'm going to say, something like 300 F-35s. Given attrition rates in air combat, those might last about 3 months in a great power conflict. So then the question is, okay, then what do you do? And, these are not questions that any of the services have faced for 70 years since the Second World War.
So what do we do? I mean, it's not like, again, obviously linked back to our, to our previous conversation about, you want to buy all these high-end items. You don't have enough to take any losses, without it materially affecting your capability. And, it's interesting. One of the things I didn't have great knowledge about that I'm trying to learn about is Taffy 3 in the Battle of the Lady Gulf, right?
Yep.
Where
yep.
The USS Johnston, under the command of Ernest Evans. And that just most improbable fight that takes place. But you look at the whole concept of a Jeep carrier, and you look at the escort destroyers, were all things that, were fielded because we needed more numbers, right? And you couldn't build everything, right? right? And so you look at that kind of industrial output, and then you look at how small we are and how high end we are, and how, you know, and it just, you know, again, you start looking at large power, and you're like, can we do that? If it's a punching event that is going to go on for months, maybe a year, can we do that? Do we, and to use the grunt word, do we have the ass to do that? And to me, it doesn't seem like we do anymore.
Well, I'll give you a optimistic answer and a pessimistic one.
Let me ask you a premise. Let me ask you a premise first. Is the premise that any of these conflicts will go on for any extended period of time, major conflict?
I mean, the short answer is no one knows, but okay. What is now part of the strategy is the possibility that it could go on for some period of time, months or even years. You know, the experience with great power conflicts is that they very often go for a long time. You know, sometimes they'll end quickly, but sometimes they go for a long time. But no matter whether they go for a short time or a long time, short months, long time, years, you know, the level of attrition is going to be far, far higher than what we have experienced for the last 70 years. Now, the optimistic part is Americans are very adaptable. And when faced with the stark circumstances, they're very good at coming up with answers. And you mentioned Jeep carriers, destroyer escorts. There are many, many more that came up during the Second World War. Right. The pessimistic part is that we are very reluctant to think about those things in peacetime. If you went to, you know, the armored community and asked them what they needed, they would say more M1 tanks. If you go to the aviation community, they would say, well, we need more F-35s. And you know, and if you say, well, you know, they're going to be shot down at a high rate, what do we do? And they say, build more F-35s. And you know, the fact that you just can't get there. I mean, yes, you would build as many F-35s as you could, but you would be replacing, you know, not even a tenth of your attrition. So what do you do? Now, I mean, the good part is that the adversary is going to have the same problem. I mean, we're going to be chewing their equipment up just the same way they're chewing ours up. So it's not like our equipment is, you know, our second line of equipment is going to be facing their first line. We'll have chewed theirs down also. But then we have to think about, okay, what is the second line? You know, could we start pulling, you know, A4s out of the desert? Are there any A4s left out there at Davis-Monthan? I don't know. I know there are a lot of aircraft out there at Davis-Monthan, and we'd probably have to start pulling those out of mothballs and sending them off into the fight. I'd say looking at whatever the Brazilians are producing, seeing if we could adapt some civilian aircraft. Sometimes people, when faced with this, say, well, we'll just do what we did in World War II. We'll convert civilian industry. And my response is, yes, the United States did that in World War II. The problem is that it began that effort in about 1938 when the United States started building a two-ocean navy and the Congress authorized a large naval expansion. The aviation industry began expanding substantially in 1939 when they started getting war orders from the British and the French. In 1940, the United States started mobilizing. There's this notion out there that, you know, Pearl Harbor happens and then the United States mobilizes for war. Totally untrue. The United States called up all of its reserve forces and began a draft in the summer of 1940, 18 months before Pearl Harbor. By Pearl Harbor, we were mobilizing absolutely as fast as we could. The problem was we had just so far to go. We had started from such a low level that it took us years. And it wasn't until 1944, which is 5 or 6 years after this industrial mobilization began, that we finally got to the point where we could go toe-to-toe with the Imperial Japanese and the Germans. Another point I make on this subject is that if you look at the fleet that sails into Tokyo Bay and takes the surrender of the Japanese, every battleship and fleet carrier in that fleet was authorized before Pearl Harbor. This was not the fleet that happened after the war began. It was a fleet that was authorized before. So industrial mobilization using civilian industry takes a long, long time. And in World War II, we also had the advantage that for the first couple of years, we could let our allies get beat up while we sat on our side of the oceans and bided our time until we built up sufficient strength. Next time, that's not going to be an option. If there's a conflict with China, we're going to be there from day one, and we're going to have large losses from day one. We're not going to have the advantage of waiting for 4, 5, 6 years. And when people raise this, I say, okay, so what are you going to do for the 4 years it takes before you can maybe really radically increase production? And people don't really have an answer, I say, because it drives you to things that you don't want to think about. Bringing back A-4s, buying Brazilian aircraft, I say, things that are just very uncomfortable.
Doesn't that have to be a part of the plan, though? Because if you don't, if you accept that we will continue to construct the highest-end technology we can, then, you know, if we run into this, then we do have to have a plan B, you know? Because, you know, how do we do it? And then I'll tell the other interesting thing, Mark, in terms
well,
of...
Well, and just to build on that, and I think we ought to have a plan B. When I say a plan B, it doesn't mean that we, you know, keep a bunch of squadrons of A-4s flying around. But do we just go out there and find out, you know, what's at Davis-Monthan and what it would take to actually reactivate them? You know, take, you know, go out there and reactivate 20 aircraft and see what happens and see if you can fly them around and see if you can make them work, you know, what you might want to, what improvements you might want to make that you could do very quickly. You know, we do that with the sea lift fleet.
Yeah, what I that's what I was going to say. But
to that do was, an analogy.
That was just in the news, right? That they that they mobilized the sea lift command and what? Between 30 and 40% of the ships could get underway after almost $1 billion being spent over the course of, I can't remember, like 5 to 7 years on that fleet. And that's pretty amazing.
Yes. But I would do those kinds of exercises just to sort of see what's possible. With the Navy, I would say, you know, keep some of the older ships in mothballs for a while. You know, keep them in mothballs for 10 years. And, you know, then after 10 years, you can go ahead and scrap them because other ships will have replaced them. But that would be your fleet replacement capability. Because the Navy is particularly vulnerable here.
Right.
You know, it takes... you know, 5 years to build a destroyer, and their ability to surge is almost nil. So that in a conflict, every destroyer the Navy loses, it just means it has one less destroyer. And, you know, if it takes some large losses in the Western Pacific, you know, you just may not have a Navy left. So they need to have, you know, the ability, again, to pull out some of these older ships, which aren't going to go toe-to-toe with the top line of the Russians or the Chinese, because we'll have destroyed those also.
Right.
It will be second line against second line.
Right. But you got to have a plan for your second line, and you got to. And again, but if the plan for the second line is that it's going to take us a year to get there, that's not a plan.
Yeah.
That's not a plan. So interesting. Interesting. All right. When can we expect to see that?
It'll come out in the spring.
Okay.
We're building the databases now. We've done a lot of the literature review. We owe something. We'll be presenting at the Naval War College or at the Naval Postgraduate School in May, I believe. And the final report will come out in July.
Got it. Well, I hope that ultimately when testimony starts and the Marine Corps does unveil its plan that you'll come back and we'll continue to critique that effort and offer constructive criticism from the bench. So, Mark, I appreciate, as always, you coming on, and I enjoy you as a guest and read your columns often. So thank you very much.
Happy to be here and happy to chat with your audience.
All right. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.